spring break, right? So you baked a cake today spring break, with your kids?
Yeah. It was a double layer chocolate cake with blue frosting.
Chocolate cake with blue frosting?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know why, but that reminds me of Cookie Monster.
Oh, is that right? Yeah, yeah. Roughly that shade of blue. A little bit more towards, like a neon, a very unnatural looking blue, actually, now that I'm thinking about it.
I think, like, I don't know why that reminds me of Cookie Monster, but I think it's because, like, you know, I just imagine that Cookie Monster is all cookies inside.
Mm-hmm.
Or like, yeah, or, and like chocolate cake. He could be just made out of chocolate cake or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Tasted good, though. We've got like a never fail. It's actually vegan. No eggs.
Oh, sweet.
No dairy. Never fail chocolate cake. It's pretty good.
Right on.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's some really good vegan chocolate cake recipes.
Mm-hmm.
Super moist. Did you eat the whole cake?
No, just a quarter of it.
Your
heavy portion control.
Yeah. But like, cake doesn't last that long. That's the problem with making a whole cake.
That's what you say to yourself.
Oh yeah, you got me, Alan.
Freezes well, Shale. Freezes
if
really
I don't
well.
Eat this slice now, tomorrow it's only gonna be half as good. Does it freeze well? Do you freeze cake?
I have, yeah. And I know one time I made it wasn't their actual wedding cake, but I made a cake for someone's wedding. For Mike and Catherine. They invited me to their wedding and asked if I would make, I had made like a chocolate stout cake for St. Patrick's Day once, and they enjoyed it, and they asked if I could make one for their wedding. And again, it wasn't their actual wedding cake. I think Erica made their wedding cake, which makes a lot more sense than me making a wedding cake. And they froze it.
I thought you were going to say that you froze it, and I was going to ask you if they knew that you froze it or not.
No.
Because they listen, so...
Yeah, that's true. I don't know why...
Mike and Catherine are avid listeners, so now they know, but yeah.
No. I don't know why. That's my frozen cake story. It's not very interesting.
They froze it because they wanted to be able to enjoy it for longer than just... how long a cake normally lasts, which is like, what, 4 hours?
No, a week, I would say.
No.
But it reminds me of the...
cake is no good after a week, Alan.
Your cake. Just cake. I don't know. but it reminds me of the Seinfeld episode about the... there's like a wedding cake. Oh, sorry, you're not a Seinfeld guy. I always run myself into
these... I've seen a few episodes.
There's one episode where Elaine's employer, Jay Peterman, buys a cake at auction, and it was like a cake from some royal wedding like decades previous. Sorry, Shale, this isn't going anywhere.
Oh, that's too bad. I wanted the story about Peterman. Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with my co-host, Alan Sudeby. Hey, Alan.
Hi, Shale.
We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it. And what are we going to talk about tonight, Alan? Wait, before we talk about stuff, I just have a little bit of follow-up. Judy had handed off a pogo whisk and a garlic peeler to you to give to me, which you dutifully did.
5 weeks after I was supposed to. Yeah.
I mean, we don't see each other in person very often, sadly. So that's not that unexpected, or it shouldn't be.
And then one day I just exploded into the Kind ice cream production.
Yeah, it was great. We were eating lunch at the time.
And I was like all disoriented. And I was like, where's Shale? I'm here. I have to give him a pogo whisk. And everyone was really confused.
Yeah. Well, the problem was that when you came in, you were masked, much like you should be. But, you know, like for an instant, I didn't recognize you. And then,
was that right?
I was like, oh, it's Alan. As soon as you spoke, I was like, oh, that's my co-host.
If you hadn't been in the room, like they would have called the cops.
Somebody
or something.
Have thrown something at you.
I got the bogo whisk.
I just got to make the drop. So you brought me the pogo whisk and the garlic peeler. I tried out the pogo whisk. I haven't actually tried it out on any food yet, but I will say that my reasoning for thinking that it would be good for like making small amounts of mayonnaise or whatever mm-hmm. was based on some misinterpretation of the scale of the pogo whisk.
Oh, okay.
When I looked at it, online, the ones that I saw made me think that they were like maybe like half the size of the actual IRL pogo whisk.
Okay.
And so, yeah, it makes a lot more sense now. Like what you were saying about how like the little stub that sticks out of the bottom, it being like a quarter inch and that being making it difficult to like contact like a small amount of sauce. That makes a lot more sense to me now. Mm-hmm. That I've seen the pogo whisk in person. I still do think that there's probably, and my other sort of like a potential use for it, like in creating a water-based foam, I think is probably still valid. Mm-hmm. I just haven't had a chance to try it out yet. I don't have any soy lecithin or anything at my house mm-hmm. to try that stuff out with. So, and the garlic peeler. Yeah, so here's the thing. I have made food with garlic since you gave me the garlic peeler, since Judy gave me the garlic peeler. Thanks, Judy. But like by the time I pull the garlic out, I already have my knife out, but I mm-hmm. don't have the garlic peeler out. So I can like quickly bash the garlic with my knife, which I basically already have in my hand, or I can go over to the drawer and pull out another tool and use it to take the skin off my garlic. And honestly, it just doesn't seem worth it to me. It's just like another tool that I'm going to need to clean. I'm already going to be cleaning my knife and it's already in my hand, and it takes like literally no seconds to take the peel off of garlic with the knife. So
you have the garlic out, you have your knife out, and then before you touch the garlic, you go, oh yeah, I have that tool that I'm supposed to try so that I can talk about it on a podcast. And then you go, but it's in the drawer.
But it's way over there, like 3 feet away in the drawer. And I don't want to take two steps. No, it's more like this, Alan.
This is not even
I'll explain to you my thought process. Okay. I'll go through the whole thing that went through my head when this happened. I had the garlic out. I was making a marinade. I had my knife out already, and I had some other vegetables on the cutting board, and I grabbed the garlic. And then I was like, this is an opportunity to try the garlic peeler. And then I was like, but am I, like, realistically, I can try the garlic peeler so that I have tried it out so that I can report back about how well it works on the podcast. Mm-hmm. Or I can do what I think that I naturally would do and then talk about that instead. That's what went through my head.
But you understand.
And what I normally would do is.
This is kind of like you had to give a book report to the class, and your book report is that you didn't read the book. That's what's happening right now.
I mean, sort of.
You're saying like, I didn't read the book because I didn't think that it would benefit me at all. But that's not really the point of what is supposed to be happening right now.
Okay. Yeah, I can see that.
Sorry, am I being too harsh?
No, I don't think so. I probably should have tried out the garlic.
Well, no. I think that if it's fine if you didn't try it. But why did we bring it up if you didn't try it?
Well, because I felt it would be conspicuous if I didn't say something about it.
You were like, I have some follow-up regarding the garlic peeler. I didn't use
Okay, I have an idea, Alan. It'll just take me a second. I'm just gonna run downstairs and grab some garlic in the garlic peeler. I'll be right back. Okay. Doop, 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 doop.
And then we just hear your car engine start. Yeah.
Okay, hi, Alan. I'm back. Hang on, hi. I gotta throw my headphones on. Okay. Okay. I grabbed the garlic peeler. And here's what happened. I grabbed the garlic peeler out of the drawer, and then I grabbed the head of garlic that was sitting on the counter, and then I went to pull off 3 cloves of garlic.
Mm-hmm.
And the first 2 cloves that I pulled off of the head of garlic literally peeled themselves as I was pulling them off the head of garlic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I was like, of course. Okay, so I brought 3 cloves, and I'm going to put them all in the garlic peeler.
Okay.
Oh, should I hold it up to the microphone so everybody can hear?
No, that's fine. Kind of squeaky.
Well, one's fully peeled. One was half peeled, and the other one not peeled at all. Yeah. I don't know. I just gave it like a lot of good squeaks. Oh, there we go. It was honestly, I mean, it's nice and clean,
mm-hmm.
and relatively undamaged. Mm-hmm. So I like that. But it took me like twice as long as it would take to do it with the knife. So I don't know.
I think, yeah, my experience as we discussed was that I was surprised with how thorough it was, and it was,
yeah.
and relatively quick. But that being said, I haven't really used it since then.
I mean, you know, like my results were sort of 50% or something.
Mm-hmm.
But to be fair, it is the first time I've used one.
Right.
But I've peeled garlic with my knife like 10,000 times.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, like I already feel like I have a really solid method for doing it. I don't,
mm-hmm.
I don't know. But you know, sometimes other people cook in my kitchen. Maybe they'll be happy that there's a garlic peeler.
Right.
And I'll have to get back to everybody about the pogo whisk. Once I actually have something that I need it for. I legit haven't used a whisk at all in my kitchen since you gave me the pogo whisk. So.
Oh, was that right?
Truly. So that was all the follow-up I had. And anyone who's read the title of the episode probably knows what the topic is already. However,
what
are we going to be talking about tonight? What's that?
We're going to talk about...
Well, hopefully the title is... What did I say? Insane restaurant reviews?
Oh, okay.
Or two bad restaurant reviews?
We're going to talk about two famous modern negative restaurant reviews.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. So one of them I kind of brought up near the end of our last episode.
Right.
Our last episode being... Amateur Menu Historian Corner Part 2.
Mm-hmm. The succinctly named Amateur Menu Historian Corner Part 2. Yep. That's right.
The best episode title that we've come up with yet. Yeah, so one of them is a review of a restaurant called Bros in an Italian city called... How do you know how to pronounce that, Alan?
Yes, it Lecce.
Lecce?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And I don't know. After we were talking about it, I said that I would put it in the show notes so that people could read it if they wanted to. But it's just so fascinating to me, the whole review. And so I just thought it would be fun to do an episode kind of talking about restaurant reviews and mm-hmm. particularly like scathing restaurant reviews.
Mm-hmm.
We don't talk a ton about food writing on the show. But I mean, we definitely both read a fair amount of it, I would say. And yeah, so I don't know. I just thought it would be fun. And so the and I thought it would be fun to sort of like compare and contrast like this review, the review of Bros from the Everywhereist blog, with like one of the most famous bad restaurant reviews, I would say, maybe of all time, which is like the review of Guy's American Kitchen in Times Square that was written by Pete Wells for the New York Times.
Yeah.
And so we're going to talk about that one first. We're going to talk about Guy's American Kitchen review first, and then we'll break down the Bros review after that.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, they're both fascinating.
Yeah. The New York Times one is especially, like, I feel like even though I've not eaten at any Guy Fieri restaurants, I think that I probably have had dining experiences similar to what is written about in that article. And what really sets it off is like the writing and the hilarious metaphors and rhetorical questions and stuff like that that are in that article. I don't know. Yeah, I actually am curious to know if that restaurant is supposed to be called it's Bros like Brothers. So I don't know if it's called Brothers or Bros or what, but
it's called Bros.
Okay.
But I don't exactly know if there's like a different Italian connotation for the word, but
right. And sorry, the writer for that one, I don't actually know how her name is pronounced, but it's Geraldine DeRuiter. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it, but
yeah,
her experience sounds like something that I've not really, like, it's so bizarre. Like I can't think of a dining experience I've had that, that sounds compare similar to what to? She experienced, yeah. And that's to me the real, the novelty and why that piece is so, interesting. It just sounds so bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think you're right. Like, in the case of the review of Guy's American Kitchen, I have definitely eaten in, you know, bad, like, high volume, you know, touristy restaurants,
yeah, novelty
that were,
chain,
you know,
restaurants. Yeah,
novelty chains that were just, you know, just built to make money, and you know, I've definitely had that type of experience before. And so like the act, like reading about the food part is like not necessarily all that exciting, you know, aside from the fact that we were talking a little bit before we were recording about like how like I don't really have anything against Guy Fieri. Like I don't necessarily love the like redneck food culture thing that he's got going on. But from what I understand, you know, he's a good person. He does a lot of charity work. He takes a lot of the money that he makes off of his redneck food empire and puts it into, you know, food programs for people who don't have access to food and stuff like that. And so I don't really, you know, like I don't have anything against Guy Fieri aside from maybe like the cultural damage that I feel like he does to food and eating in some way.
Okay.
Like,
yeah.
just like in terms of like the taste making that he promotes, I just don't really agree with his I don't really agree with like the appeal of the food that he is promoting or that he is, you know, always talking about or whatever.
I mean, I understand what you're saying, but I would say that like early in my career, and I just haven't watched it in a while, but like Diners, Drive-Ins and Dives was a show that I genuinely enjoyed watching.
Oh, me too. Yeah. And there are things on it that I saw that I was like, oh, that looks amazing. And I would love to eat that.
Yeah.
You know, like, but it's more like, and they kind of talk about this in the review a little bit too. It's like, you know, like what's great about Diners, Drive-Ins and Dives, Oh, sorry. From now on, I'm going to call it Triple D. Just so we don't. What's great about Triple D is that he goes to places where they make this like crazy over the top food, but it's like the specialty of this like one shop that's making it, you know, mm-hmm. and doing it like in a really excellent way. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, like you take that and you take the philosophy of like that over the top eating or whatever that's prevalent in that like, you know, Triple D food culture in the States, and you transplant it into another place that's sort of trying to like replicate it or whatever and wind up doing it badly. Mm-hmm. And I sort of feel like, you know, like the places that he goes to on the show that are great, I would love to go to those places, but I don't necessarily want to go to a restaurant that makes something that they saw on Triple D.
Yeah.
You know,
like, yeah, the difference is that like, I do think like to his credit, he's an excellent hype man for those diners, like those small, like mom and pop shops, yeah. That were just making great comfort food. But then, yeah, of course, when you open a restaurant in Times Square and franchise it and all that, like, yeah,
it's 500 seats.
Yes, like, that's right.
That's,
yeah,
that's a yeah. big restaurant.
So, anyways, that yeah, I do think that Triple D is like a modern classic of food TV. But yeah, the restaurant, whether it's Guy's American Kitchen and Bar or the Tex Wasabi stuff or Johnny Garlic's, like that does seem to be like a something else entirely. Like yeah. So yeah, this review the actual review is from the New York Times. It was published on November 13th, 2012, so very topical on our it's 10 years old.
Well, okay, so but here's what's amazing about that. Like yeah, it's like a decade old now.
Mm-hmm.
But like to find it, all I had to do was search for Guy Fieri bad review.
Yes.
Like that is yeah. like definitely the first thing that came up.
Yeah.
So like, I don't know if it's just because it was in the New York Times or like it has like a viral quality.
Oh yeah, know? Absolutely. Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And it's like really, like it's pretty amazing for something on the internet to just be still like at the top of your Google search like a decade later, a decade after it came out. Like mm-hmm. the restaurant doesn't exist anymore, right?
Not yeah, Times Square location Times Square, is closed. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think there's still several other
Guy's American Kitchen.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's pretty amazing. Like, I don't know if it's like to the credit of the piece of writing. I mean, I think that's partially it, but I think it's more just like how it kind of like exploded because everyone, I guess, probably wanted to bandwagon jump, you know, on like talking about how bad Guy Fieri's like weird like transplant restaurant was or whatever.
Right. It's. Do we need to give a little bit of like just read some things off the menu so that people understand, like if they're not familiar with what kind of food this place was serving, to kind of contextualize?
Sure. Or yeah, is that I think that's reasonable. Yeah. I mean, I think the first thing that people should know, and like and one of the things that I think is fascinating that that Pete Wells talks about in the review mm-hmm. is that when you walk in, there's a sign over the door that says "Welcome to Flavor Town."
Yeah. So one of the most famous sort of like Guy Fieri-isms of all time, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think that that's sort of like he uses that as a bit of like irony, kind of like throughout the review mm-hmm. or whatever. Is that like you're being welcomed to Flavor Town, but really everything in the restaurant is like mediocre in flavor.
Right. I think just the very fact that if you search out Guy's American Kitchen and Bar online. There's not one menu. There's like more than a dozen locations, and it seems like they all have their own menus. But I think I found one here. This is from a location in Connecticut. And just to give you an example of like the kind of language and the kind of offerings that are on the menus, like for appetizers, we've got trash can nachos and smothered dragon chili croc, pastrami egg rolls, chili cheese fries. And so, yeah, the like that kind of language, like trash can nacho, and the idea of like this really bold fusion, like pastrami egg roll. And there's lots of like just kind of marketing language, like donkey sauce. You know donkey sauce?
I mean, I don't know too much about it, honestly. I understand that it's a thing that, you know, that is associated with Guy Fieri, but I don't know what it is. Do you know what it is?
Yeah, it's just garlic mayo.
Oh, okay.
Like it's a, actually Guy Fieri describing it on some websites, and it's like, it's a blend of garlic, mayo, mustard, Worcestershire, and salt and pepper. And it's just called donkey sauce, quote, because you have to make fun of it. It's a quintessential ingredient in so many aspects of food, yet probably not the most beneficial except for flavor. Probably the least, that doesn't even make sense actually what he's saying, but it's just a marketing, it's just his fun word for it. Although I have the first of many quotes that I wanted to share from the Pete Wells piece was, he says, with regards to the donkey sauce, when we quote, when we hear donkey sauce, which part of the donkey are we supposed to think of?
Yeah, I love that bit too. What I think is really, I don't know. Like, I think what really probably like pushed that piece over the top in terms of how viral it became, is just the what is that? The like, it's written as a,
it's addressed rhetorical. To Guy Fieri.
Yeah, it's addressed to Guy Fieri and written basically as a rhetorical questionnaire.
Yes.
About the things that happened when they went to the restaurant. And some of those things are like really bad service that they received.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so the author is like, Guy, you know, like, do you realize that these are the types of things that are going on in the restaurant that has your name attached to it? And yeah, I don't know. It's kind of brilliant. It's not even really that long. I remembered it being a longer piece than it actually is. It's probably what, only like 500 words or
no, maybe. Oh, is that right? I wouldn't be able to say actually. But yeah, it's not a long read for sure. But yeah, that it's written in the second person and addressed to Guy is it actually, I feel like that's kind of part of a tradition of like critical writing, like there's like Bob Dylan songs like that where it's like, and you did this and what do you think about how you did this, and like
right and like, yeah, calling out the person
exactly
for,
yeah and yes, the
you just don't see a lot of food writing with
no,
you know, written from that perspective.
Yeah, and it's funny because I think oftentimes you and I would like go to bat for a restaurant owner, like their name gets put on something and obviously they're not like there in the kitchen, but you understand that it's like it's a business and all that. But yeah, this one, he just goes straight for the, not straight for the jugular, but I mean like straight to the issue where it's like, you're a celebrity, you're putting your name on it, it's not very good. Like, this is on you.
Yeah, yeah. Why don't you do something about this?
Yeah.
Which, yeah, I mean, it occurs to me, like, I don't know, I think what's going on in the back of my head when I read the review is like, I mean, I don't know how much involvement Guy Fieri has in like even the menu writing for this restaurant, but mm-hmm. like, it occurs to me that probably, you know, logistically, just to have a restaurant in Times Square that's 500 seats, like, you probably, I mean, I don't know for sure, but I can't imagine that they weren't like taking the menu ideas and then finding convenience products to fill the, you know, to fill out the menu. Like, it, mm-hmm. it would surprise me to hear that, you know, like, everything that's on that menu, like, is made from scratch in-house. Like, I don't know, maybe right. that is what was happening, but, like, I don't know, from some of the descriptions of the food in the review mm-hmm. and from, you know, just, like, thinking about the logistical aspect of setting up a 500-seat restaurant in Times Square, like, probably they, like, made a menu and tested out a few things, and definitely, like, there are some dishes that they wanted to try to keep as close to what the original idea was, but, like, probably for lots of things they were like, oh, you know, like, normally, I don't know, maybe more normally with the donkey sauce, maybe you'd, like, make it from scratch in some way or something, but mm-hmm. you know, they're probably just mixing, like, two convenience products or whatever, so mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and then you wind up with, you know, something that's really mediocre, and then somebody, you know, comes in and decides that it's the day that they're gonna take Guy Fieri to task,
right? Yeah,
about his celebrity or whatever.
That's yeah, and the tone is set so quickly. Like, the very first line of it is Guy Fieri, have you eaten at your new restaurant in Times Square? Right. And yeah, those kinds of. Those, yeah, the endless rhetorical questions addressed to him are actually really, really funny. Like,
I'm just going to read a passage.
Yeah.
Did panic grip your soul as you stared into the whirling hypno wheel of the menu where adjectives and nouns spin in a crazy vortex? When you saw the burger described as Guy's Pat LaFrieda custom blend all natural Creekstone Farm Black Angus beef patty LTOP lettuce tomato onion pickle in parentheses SMC super melty cheese in parentheses and a slathering of donkey sauce on garlic buttered brioche, did your mind touch the void for a minute?
Okay. And actually, okay, I have read the menus from various Guy's American Kitchen and Bars. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if they all do this, but one of the really frustrating things about them was that they have all these catchy acronyms on them, like LTOP, lettuce, tomato, onion, pickle. But on at least right. three of them, every time they use the acronym afterwards in parentheses,
they put the parentheses.
They say, so it says LTOP parentheses, lettuce, tomato, onion, pickle every single time that they use yeah. the acronym. It's
like they've never heard of an asterisk, I guess. just like the name of this burger on the menu is like three sentences.
Yeah, exactly.
It's ridiculous.
One of my favorite rhetorical questions is what exactly makes Guy's famous Big Bite Caesar A, big, B, famous, or C, Guy's?
In any meaningful
yeah,
sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, the review is really funny. It's really great. I mean, personally, I probably wouldn't go to Guy's American Kitchen and Bar, but I probably wouldn't go in with very high expectations, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. But I guess, I don't know, like maybe, yeah, I'm probably not most people, I guess. So,
right. Yeah.
You know, people probably really trust Guy Fieri's taste, you know, in terms of his passion about like comfort food and diner food and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so there are probably lots of people who wind up in Times Square and they're like, whoa, Guy Fieri's restaurant.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
we got to eat there. It's going to be amazing. And then, yeah, apparently the food doesn't live up to the descriptions on the menu.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of... It's very quotable. There's just lots of great quotes.
Totally. I mean, he describes the nachos, and like I had heard of the trash can nachos before, but he doesn't say in the review that they were the trash can nachos. Mm-hmm. But he does say that like some of the nacho chips were fried lasagna noodles. That seems crazy to
that
me.
That was very odd to me too, yeah. And I don't think he was, like, I think he was being quite literal. Like, my interpretation is that was that they literally were fried lasagna noodles. Me too.
I'm pretty sure, because you can fry pasta and it gets crispy, mm-hmm. but it's kind of hard to pull off. And I could see it being really horrible, like, mm-hmm. you know, if it wasn't quite done right, like, because it could be, like, really chewy and horrible.
Yeah.
If you don't quite get it right, so.
And I've not eaten them, and I haven't actually seen this spelled out in any writing online, but my understanding is that the trash can nachos are basically like nachos that have been, they're like piled up as a cylinder, like they're kind of baked, mm-hmm.
they're
in
assembled
a cylinder.
In a can,
yeah and so like the melted cheese holds them into this like novel like tall cylinder, so it kind of looks like a garbage can when it's unmolded, which is fine.
Yeah, I mean it's dramatic. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm sure. Yeah. Anyways, it's a great piece of writing, and you know, I don't want to rip on Guy Fieri, like I said off the top, but like, you know, I don't know. I just feel like this review when it came out, it was sort of like in a perfect storm, like of where I think people were ready to like rip on Guy Fieri and you know jump on board. Mm-hmm. And it just I mean it's probably I don't know, I was gonna say it's, you know, it's probably not the like best ever written piece of like it's probably not the best piece of like satire that's been written as a restaurant review, but man, like it's pretty classic. I think the time and place that it was written, it just like, I don't know, up into something.
I think one of the reasons that it has lasted so long is that it like it's not I guess in a way it is kind of pretentious, but like it's the descriptions of the food and all that, like it really does just sound like the food was bad, and it's not like some kind of quibbling self-righteous food critic that's like trying to flex how much they know. It's just like he asked, like one of the lines is like, why did the toasted marshmallows taste like fish? Like he's just like,
yeah,
does a really good job of it.
The heart of the review is really like about how, you know, kind of contrasting the way the food is like marketed on the menu, mm-hmm. versus how kind of like mediocre it actually wound up being when it came to the table. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't, I mean, you know, you could be cynical and say that he threw a few things in here about how not all of the food was bad, yep. just to sort of like, you know, buy himself some credibility or mm-hmm. something. Mm-hmm. But I don't think like it doesn't. Yeah. I think it doesn't ring as like dishonest to me, you know,
yeah.
like
yeah
it's, you know, like that the French fries were not very crispy and cold doesn't surprise me that much, you know, right. like it, you know, it seems realistic. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the heart of the review I think is just like about how the idea is that, yeah, you're going to go to Guy Fieri's restaurant and you're going to get this really over the top food experience. And then you read the menu and that's what it depicts, is like this crazy, you know, over the top food that you probably can't get anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And then it comes to the table, like the, you know, that crazy burger that I described just comes to the table and it's just like, you know, a flimsy overcooked
right.
burger with bad fries, you know. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, well, what happened to the all natural Creekstone Farm Black Angus beef patty LTOP SMC melty cheese and slathering of donkey sauce that I ordered.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, I think it's a fascinating piece of writing. It's pretty hilarious. I wonder how much the watermelon margarita really actually tastes like radiator fluid and formaldehyde. I've never tasted either radiator fluid or formaldehyde, so that to me rings like a little bit like hyperbole.
Laying it on a little thick there, Peter.
Yeah, yeah. Come on, Pete. Yeah, but it's good. But should we move on to the Bros review?
Sure, yeah.
Okay. So this review, I heard about it originally. I think I saw something fly by on social media, but the author of this review, Geraldine DeRuiter, I assume is how it's pronounced, was interviewed on CBC Radio.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
And then that popped up on social media for me somewhere.
Like she was interviewed about this review or about this experience?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So I can't remember who it was who interviewed her. I should remember, but I'm a bad CBC listener now. Yeah, it was like a fairly quick interview, and it basically just like, you know, asked her about details of the meal.
Mm-hmm.
Asked her to sort of like re-describe details of the meal that she'd had.
Right.
And I'm not sure why it caught the CBC's eye. Mm-hmm. Exactly, but it is a pretty amazing description of like what sounds like the worst quote unquote like Michelin starred meal that you could have.
Right. So the restaurant Bros is in Lecce in Apulia in Italy. So it's Apulia is the province that's like, it's the heel of the boot.
Okay.
And this is, yeah, like it's a, this was a Michelin starred restaurant. And in a,
do you know how many stars they have? Is it a single starred restaurant?
Oh, I don't know actually. It's just the title of her, original post was Bros Lecce. We eat at the worst Michelin starred restaurant ever. In a way, the big similarity between the Guy Fieri review in the New York Times and this one is that they both like massively overpromise and underdeliver.
Right.
But kind of on the opposite end of the dining spectrum, where this one is supposed to be like, a Michelin star, a very fancy and nuanced, sophisticated dining experience. And what does she say? They get served 27 courses over 4.5 hours.
Right.
But she insists that like not a single one of those offerings was a proper course in any sense. Like that there were the portions were so small, and the food like so stripped back or unrecognizable, like that it was laughable to her. And so she talks about like there being courses that are slivers of edible paper and courses that are just like shot glasses of what she says is vinegar.
Right.
And that every single course of the 27, she says, was cold.
Right.
And so despite the really hefty bill at the end of the night and all the time spent there, like none of them felt like they had been nourished in any sense. Like,
yeah,
they hadn't been fed. Right?
Yeah. That's basically the situation, is that like, you know, they paid for a meal and, you know, like when you think about having a 27 course meal,
yeah,
you don't want 27 courses to be a big amount of food, right? Like,
yeah.
You expect each course to be relatively small. If you're going to eat 27 courses, you don't necessarily expect that they're all going to be like the same size courses that you would have at a meal where you're getting three courses.
Oh, of
right?
course, yeah.
You would keel over by like the fifth course.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it would just be way too much food. So, you know, you're kind of expecting smallish portions. But you also wouldn't expect to get to the end of a 27-course meal and feel like you'd basically eaten nothing.
Yes.
And that was basically her experience. Mm-hmm. There's a quote in here. Where was that? So in talking about the courses, she says, amassing 24 of them together amounted to a meal, the same way amassing 24 toddlers together amounts to one middle-aged adult.
Right.
It's like not, you can put out 27 courses of food, but if none of the courses contain like anything that's more significant than like a tablespoon of sauce or something, right, then you're not going to feel like you ate anything, you know?
I don't know if this was meant to be taken literally or not, but she says that she was served 12 kinds of foam over the 27 right. courses. So that gives
there are quite a few photos also in the, and I'll put the link to this review. I'll put links to both of these reviews in the show notes again, mm-hmm. So that people can go through and look. But if you look at the pictures, like, yeah, there are a lot of pictures of tiny little portions of foam.
Mm-hmm. So besides the portioning and all that, there are a couple of dishes that she describes that are really unsettling, just gastronomically. And one of them, the most shocking, is a course. It also a kind of foam.
Oh my God,
I think she
Alan.
Says a citrus foam, but it is served in a little bowl that's actually a plaster mold of the chef's mouth. And so it's served without.
This was the point when reading this review that I just like it became indelibly imprinted on my brain forever. Like, this was the point in reading the review where I just suddenly had a revelation about how bad a meal could possibly be. Like, how far off the scale of, like, we're clearly not serving you a meal for your enjoyment. We're clearly serving you a meal to challenge your ability to sit through an experience.
It sounds like, you know, something like from the futurist cookbook menu that we talked about
yeah,
last time.
It like, really does.
Yeah, like licking a foam out of a plaster mold of the chef's mouth where you can see like his teeth and stuff. Like, it's disgusting.
I don't think the review mentions the chef's name at all, but
yeah, not that I can remember.
Man, I wonder now. I'm super curious now because he's Italian. I wonder if he has some kind of like connection to futurist cuisine or something like that.
I don't know.
Yeah, there's a picture of the plaster cast of the chef's mouth that you're supposed to lick this foam out of, like in the review.
Yeah.
And it is so disgusting. Like, it just, oh man, it just turns my stomach. There's like a little bit of the foam like dribbling out of the corner of the mouth.
Yeah.
And like, oh.
Yeah.
And like, this is a quibble, but like, this is a ridiculous quibble. But like, if, like, let's just say that I was insane enough that I, you know, I had a Michelin-starred restaurant, and I wanted to challenge diners by serving them a course of food out of a plaster cast of my mouth.
Okay.
Like, let's just say that I was a crazy narcissist like that.
Yeah.
Like, this plaster cast looks like the worst. Like, it looks so unpleasant to eat out of. Like, it look, you know, like, it's not glazed at all, you know, like it just looks like rough plaster.
Yeah.
And like, I just, man, like, it, at least if it was like a finished piece of like of pottery or something, I could see it. But this is clearly just like, oh, I've got an idea, get some plaster, we're gonna, man.
Yeah, it looks,
it's, yeah. Yeah. And that section of the review comes right after the part which, and this was something that she talked about in the CBC interview. But like, one of the dishes was brought to the table, and the server put it down and said that it was made from rancid ricotta.
Mm-hmm.
And so they thought, okay, you know, maybe we're not quite hearing it right, or maybe, you know, like maybe it's a different, maybe the word for rancid in Italian is not the same thing, and maybe there's just a miscommunication here.
Right.
And so one of the diners was like, oh, you mean like fermented or something? And then the server was like, no, rancid, ranchito, or rancido. And yeah, that's, I mean, I don't know. I haven't tried the dish. Maybe there's something about rancid ricotta, but I mean, I've smelled rancid ricotta before, and it does not smell appealing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And she goes through like a lot of the dishes in this review and basically just, you know, lays out pretty much exactly what they were, like, like a teaspoon of olive ice cream. And there's a picture of it, and it looks so horrible, Alan. It's like... like it may be ice cream, like it may be olive ice cream inside this like little pellet that is served in this bowl, but like the entire outside of this piece of ice cream is like covered in ice crystals. Like it, right. Like it sat out uncovered in a freezer for like 3 days or something before they decided to serve it.
Mm-hmm.
It looks so horrible and unappealing. Yeah. And also like, it doesn't really do our listeners much good for me to talk about the visual aspect of this review, but like, just in an overall sense, like all of the pictures, like they don't look like they're badly taken pictures. They don't look like, you know, product photography or anything, but you know, they look like reasonably well lit and, you know, reasonably well composed photos that someone would take for their blog that they're going to write about a meal that they had.
Right.
And just about every dish, like there are a few that have some kind of like presentation that I think looks somewhat appealing, like maybe one or two, but just about all of them just look so like how little food there is on the plate is only like, augmented by the fact that it looks like so little effort was put into making it look like anything appealing at all.
Yeah.
Like just all of the dishes look like they're just like really like there's just nothing going on in terms of presentation.
Mm-hmm.
Like there are a couple that clearly there is like some sort of presentation idea, but yeah, I don't know. There's like picture of a bowl full of like a crab salad.
That's exactly the one I was thinking.
Literally just looks like
a lump of shredded crab.
Crab with maybe some kind of dressing in it or something. Mm-hmm. There's no color, no other component, nothing. It's just like a tablespoon of crab in this little bowl. I don't think she ever says what she paid, what they paid for the meal. I mean, she does say a few times that it was quite expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, and apparently, like, the service was really bad as well. A couple of times, people got up to, like, go to the bathroom or to, like, get some air or something. It was a 4.5-hour meal. A couple of times, diners, like, got up to stretch or something and were asked by the servers to sit back down.
Yeah. And
that seems pretty crazy to me.
I mean, we all want to be able to do that working in the kitchen, like, when you... when you're firing the entrees and then you put them in the pass and go, actually,
the dish,
they've gone out for
you
a
want
smoke.
To be able, yeah.
But yeah, it's not something that you should do.
It's not something that you can do. Mm-hmm. It's just, yeah.
Though, yeah, so bad service, like, and this is honestly a little bit a part of European dining culture, but like she says that they were like, didn't pay any attention to the dietary restrictions of the guests.
Right.
Didn't make any kind of accommodation in that regard. But to be honest, that is much less. I would expect a Michelin-starred restaurant to be more thoughtful, but that's much less of a thing in Europe than it is in North America.
I kind of hear what you're saying. I got to say, I somewhat agree, but I somewhat disagree.
In a fine dining Michelin starred context, they should absolutely be paying attention to it. But I don't know. This is basically a provincial.
Yeah. Kind of place. And in my experience, they did. Like, I don't have a ton of allergies or anything like that. And so I didn't, you know, I wasn't really testing that at every restaurant that I ate at when I was traveling in Europe. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I do know for sure that at Noma and at Fiskebar, if patrons had allergies, we knew, like, we asked when they made a reservation, and right. then we made whatever accommodation was necessary to meet everyone's dietary restrictions. Mm-hmm. Like, especially at Noma, it was a huge deal. Mm. Like, and you could have like the craziest dietary restrictions ever, and we would still serve like an unbelievable 24 course meal.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
There was always a way to make it work. Mm-hmm. And we always found a way to make it work. And same with Fiskebar. Like, we were very careful about people's dietary restrictions. I mean, you know, we were cooking for those people. Sometimes the cooks would complain about having to make those accommodations, but, you know, we were very careful about making sure that, you know, everyone's like, I hear what you're saying, but it's also a part of European dining culture that you really want the customers to have, every customer to have the best experience. And that was mostly my experience in eating in most places in Europe where I went. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe not some like rustic hole in the wall, like, you know, places where I went for dumplings in Poland or something like that. You right. know, I wouldn't necessarily yeah. expect that they would have something for everyone's dietary needs. Like, they have what's on the menu and that's basically it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, most of the fancy restaurants that I ate in, I don't think it was like ever a question that, you know, like, they would pay attention to your dietary restrictions. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But this is clearly, like, in this review, she's saying that, like, they asked about their dietary restrictions and yes. then just ignored them.
And then they either served them nothing or just served them things that they couldn't eat anyways. That
they were allergic to.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And the big, so yeah, besides the quality of the food, the portioning, the service or lack thereof, the real like overarching thing for me in this is just like how overbearing, like how pretentious it all was. Like, that she says mm-hmm. there's not actually a menu. You're given I think she said a piece of newspaper that has a QR code, and then it just like yeah. sends you to a video of the chef talking about their philosophy. And so, and that's the, right. that's the quote menu. So you can't order anything.
Like, man, you're kind Alan, of... that sounds so futurist.
It does too. Yeah.
Doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Multimedia and like, but it sounds annoying. Like, it sounds.
Yeah, exactly.
Super.
Oh, well, then what are we going to eat? Well, you'll find out when we bring it to the table. What if I can't eat it? Well, don't worry. We'll make you eat it anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like just a terrible experience. And then I think they said after the 27 courses, they were kind of ushered, did she say, across the street into another location where they were served like
yeah.
Digestives and watched another video or something like about,
oh,
right. or they were served cheese or something.
Well, also, like, unsolicited, the chef like came out and like basically forced them to take a picture with him. Yeah. I think that's before they went across the street. Mm. Where was that? I'm going to try and find it here. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I found it. Yeah. No, it is after I think it's after what they went across the street. Okay. Yeah. I found it. Okay. Actually, I'm just going to read the last, like, this little bit near the end here, because it's fascinating. So they've finished their meal. Their last course was a marshmallow flavored like cuttlefish. That was the dessert, I guess. And a dish called frozen air, which literally melted before you could eat it, which felt like a goddamn metaphor for the night. Excuse my language. Um, So yeah, this is the piece. And then someone came in and demanded we stand and exit the restaurant. Thinking we were getting kicked out, we gleefully followed. Instead, we were led across the street to a dark doorway and into the bro's laboratory. A video of the shirtless kitchen staff doing extreme sports played on a large TV screen, while a chef cut us comically tiny slivers of fake cheese, which one of the diners was allergic to. The bill arrived. The meal cost more than any other we'd eat during our trip by a magnitude of 3. They'd given us balloons with the restaurant's name across it, and the chef emerged and insisted on posing with us for a Polaroid that we did not ask for. We were finally released into the night after every other restaurant had closed, ensuring that no food would be consumed that evening. I mean, it's funny, and it's written in a funny way, but it doesn't... I don't doubt that what she's saying is like true. Mm-hmm. And then, oh my God, there's a PS also in this post, mm-hmm. which I think is just like the most amazing icing on the cake. PS, the next day, one of the staff tried contacting the only single female member of our party via Instagram messages. Hey, I served you last night, he wrote. She immediately blocked him. So they had this really horrible meal with really horrible service, and then one of the servers found one of them on Instagram and hit on her. It's like, yeah, you couldn't even make that up.
Yeah. It just, yeah, the whole thing sounds like I get it. When you have a fancy restaurant and you want to like, you've got ways that you do things and you want to show people that or explain it to people. But there's a line where like, if the service staff becomes kind of like tone deaf to what the customer is actually experiencing and what the customer actually wants, like it's so overbearing right. and exhausting to go through a service like that. They're kind of like,
well, and I think like you can, you know, if the idea is to make an artistic statement about, you know, what food can be or something, or if there is some kind of futurist context here or something mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, there, yeah, the tone deaf, I think, like the way you put it, is the perfect way to say it. It's like, you know, there's a way to give the customer that experience in a way that will like help them take something away from it. You know, like mm-hmm. there's a way to communicate that to the guest in a way that is going to like give them an idea of, you know, what it is that you're trying to show them or right. what it is that you're trying to. Yeah, like what you're trying to say about food or something like that. But it just seems like there was no context here. Mm-hmm. And no one was able to provide any of the diners with any sort of context. Right. And it was just like a tragically... And so, and therefore, you know, if like what the chef was striving for was some sort of artistic statement about food, what wound up happening was just a tragically bad meal. You know, like,
yeah.
And I don't know, like, I haven't eaten there and I don't know this chef. Maybe that is what he is trying to provide people with, a tragically horrible experience. But I can't really think of a justification for that. I don't know.
And it seems unlikely that a place like that would, well, first of all, have a Michelin star. But also, I think that Geraldine, like, makes numerous references to having seen photos and read reviews of other people who have eaten there at different times, and they right. seem to
and
have
had
genuinely,
actual reasonably good meals.
Yeah, enjoyed yeah. themselves and been served pasta, like real dishes of pasta and stuff like that, right. which is what makes it so, I guess, confusing, like the experience that she had and why, and yeah, begs the question why that would happen and why it would be so wildly different from what a lot of other people experience there. But yeah,
one of my favorite metaphors that she uses, you probably wrote this down in your notes too, but one of my favorite metaphors is she said that earlier in the day they'd seen a statue of a bear that was carved by someone who had never seen a bear but who had had one described to them. Right. And she says that that's what the restaurant was like. It was like a restaurant made by someone who had had restaurants and food described to them, but had never actually been to a restaurant or had food.
Yeah. Yes.
It's really good. Anyways.
I mean, it's ice cold.
I think we should go eat there, Alan.
Sure. Okay.
If someone wants to sponsor us to go eat there, I would love to write my own review about this place.
Do you have any thoughts on, like, as a chef, what it's like to be reviewed? Or is that, we didn't really prep for this part of the conversation, but
no, that's true, but that's an interesting question. I have like both positive and negative like feelings and experiences mm-hmm. with it. You know, like it's always great if you get a good review, mm-hmm. but usually as a chef, you like see the things even in a good review that are, I don't know, like kind of misinterpretations of what it is that is actually going on behind the scenes, or mm-hmm. how, you know, like, or the misinterpretation of the intentions of certain parts of dishes or things like that.
Right.
Like, it's pretty uncommon for me to read a review of food that I've made and fully agree whether it's good or bad.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty uncommon for me to fully agree with the interpretation of whoever it is that's writing about the food.
Yeah, there's almost always something that's like factually incorrect. I don't know if that's what you mean, but like in a description of,
I mean,
like,
that's part of it for sure. Factually incorrect is definitely part of it. That usually does happen, and that happens in like all like reporting. I feel like mm-hmm. there's usually any like reporting that I've ever seen about incidents that I was involved in or had witnessed, mm. there's usually factual inaccuracies. And I'm always like, really? Mm. Is every news story that is out there this inaccurate also? Well, and yeah, I don't know. It's hard. It's hard to get everything totally factually accurate.
Oh yeah. But there's there's probably only maybe a handful of writers and publications that have reviewed stuff that I've done.
Mm-hmm.
And only one of them, but multiple times, has contacted me before publishing it to ask questions and
right.
to make clarifications, which is
right.
kind of crazy that it's not, you'd think that would be best practice. But like it
totally,
yeah. So when that doesn't happen, yeah, you're definitely opening yourself up or to probably not the best quality of reporting.
I would say that, I mean, like, this is clearly not true of every instance, but I would say like in a lot of cases, that's often the difference between like a professional reporting scenario and a food blog, you know? Like,
yeah, that's definitely one. Well, okay, I'll just say it right, like, be upfront about it. Like Twyla Campbell, who writes for does reviews for CBC, like she's the yeah. only one who in my experience has ever reached out to ask questions and get clarifications.
Right.
And that's not to say that like everyone else is just a food blogger. Like I've had stuff written in the Edmonton Journal and the Edmonton
yeah.
Sun.
I have been contacted by the Edmonton Journal though
oh, is
about
that right? yeah.
things before as
yeah.
well.
Okay.
Yeah. Like to check facts and things like
mm-hmm.
that.
Oh, that's cool.
Not every time.
Yeah.
But yeah. But sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I don't know. Like that's sort of my overall statement about having critiques done about my food is that, like, you know, whether they're good or bad, there are usually things in them that I'm like, well, that's kind of a misinterpretation of what was actually going on or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like I have had some like negative things written about food that I've made before, and that's tough. And it's especially tough if like you agree.
Oh, really? Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I've been in that situation before too, where I have, you know, served meals that weren't, you know, like weren't what they were supposed to be or weren't as good as they were supposed to be and had them written about. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's pretty painful.
Yeah.
Like knowing that you put out something that wasn't as good as it should have been and then getting called out for it is definitely like, not fun, but definitely also is, you know, good to help you look at your, you know, self or help you try to, you know, solve the problems that led to the situation of someone getting a dish that wasn't ideal or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's good. I have read some reviews that were not about me wherein I feel like maybe, you know, the writer's stance was not entirely fair. But right. You know, like I guess in most of those cases I wasn't at those meals either, so
right.
It's hard for me to say, but yeah. Overall, I feel like food criticism is like valuable and valid.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes friggin' hilarious.
Yes. It's tough. Yeah, I obviously agree that food criticism and the whole public discourse, yes, obviously that's a good thing. It is tough. Like even if you think about Guy's American Kitchen and Bar in New York Times. Sorry. Oh God, I keep saying that in Times Square in New York. Sorry.
Times Square. Well, I mean, I believe the square is named after the paper. Am I crazy?
I actually don't know. That sounds plausible to me. The thing is that regardless of how bad the food and service was for Pete Wells, like there's a lot of people who are working at the restaurant and they don't know Guy and they're just there to do a totally. Job. And it's kind of, in a way, a lot of it's just out of their control. And I feel bad for them to have something so harsh written about where they had to go to work the next day. But I mean,
right. I can see that.
He puts it pretty squarely at the feet of Guy Fieri, not at like the, you know, the maitre d' or whatever, but like, yeah, it's tough.
I mean, I can definitely see that, but here's what I have to say about that is that like if it was about any other restaurant, if it was about a mom and pop shop, if it was about a small restaurant wherein like, you know, having such a horribly scathing review could really damage the business and the business owners and things like that. Like, I doubt it would have been written.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's like, you know, Guy Fieri's 500 seat restaurant in Times Square. I mean, it's closed now for whatever reason. I don't know why that is. Maybe it's COVID related for all I know, mm-hmm. but you know, like, I doubt that review's existence did anything to deter like the 500 tourists an hour that sit down in that place and order trash can nachos.
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
You know, I don't think that review damaged the, you know, restaurant or probably the people that work there,
right.
You know, like it probably did nothing to dissuade people from going there, mm-hmm. because the people that are going there don't care about that review or maybe would never wind up reading it, you know.
Oh, so. Yeah, I'm sure. I don't think very many people who are eating there would be reading the New York Times. Well, I mean, partly
because it's
tourists.
Probably mostly tourists.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, well, if they're going to read the Times, they probably like read it because they're in New York and it's like
right. Yeah.
Fun to read the newspaper of the city that they're visiting or whatever. But I imagine that not very many people not very many people who live in New York eat in that restaurant. Mm-hmm. And, you know,
yeah.
So I, you know, like, I think contextually that's part of the reason why it works is because, like, you know, you're, you know, like, you're kind of picking on a giant that it's not really, you're not,
right.
Who you're not really going to be hurting by saying those things or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't remember if there was ever a response from Guy Fieri about it. I feel like maybe there was some sort of short response from Guy Fieri on social media about it. Do you remember?
I don't know about the responding to the Pete Wells piece specifically, but I've read Fieri's reactions to other criticism. Like, I think that Bourdain said something kind of nasty about him. And I remember being very impressed by Guy's response. Like, he was just like, listen, like, I don't know that dude. He doesn't really know me. I'm just doing my thing. Like, it was actually pretty, like, a pretty mature comeback. So,
yeah. Yeah, fair enough. We can talk about it more when we start our all Guy Fieri podcast.
Or, like, is there, like things that Bourdain has ripped apart? Like, that could be a whole, I don't know.
He's that could be a whole podcast.
Some pretty scathing, well, or at least an episode of this one, yeah.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.